Hi, I know this is a recorded session, but I would have loved to be live, but I don't think I can pull it off. But here's what I'd like to do in this session. I'd like to continue with our discussion of pricing. Remember, we said the way you price something is to look at what other things just like it are being priced, and you attach a number to an asset or a company or an equity. So it's a very simple process. It's a much less intellectually involved process than intrinsic valuation. And for a lot of people, it's more appealing. And we talked about the fact that it's not pricing that's a problem, it's lazy pricing. So I suggested a four-step process for making sure you do pricing right. And the four-step process starts by defining the multiple. You're saying, well, I know what the PE ratio is. I know what the EV to EBITDA is. And that's what I want to start with today, because I said there are two tests you need to run to make sure that the multiple that you're using, because remember, you've got to standardize the price to compare across companies, is in fact a consistently defined multiple. And we said the numerator is an equity value, the denominator is to be an equity value. So price earnings ratio clearly passes the test. Price is an equity value, earnings per share is an equity value. EV to EBITDA clearly passes the test. EV is the value of the operating assets of the company. EBITDA is a measure of the operating cash flow. That's okay too. But price to EBITDA, we said, was fundamentally flawed. So is it consistently defined? I want to build on that notion for the next few slides. But I also want to remind you of the second question you need to ask when you define a multiple. Is it uniformly estimated? You're saying, what's the big deal? If I'm going to compare PE ratios across 15 companies, I want the earnings per share to be estimated the same way across the 15 companies. You're saying, but if you have the same accounting standards, doesn't it automatically happen? I wish. Because companies vary in terms of how much fidelity they have to the accounting standards. Without even breaking the rules, you can aggressively measure earnings or be conservative in measuring earnings. And if you don't control for that, here's what's going to happen. Companies that are aggressively measuring earnings will always look cheaper to you on a PE ratio basis. So is it consistently defined? Is it uniformly estimated? So what I'd like to do is take you through a series of multiples to see what the consistency question brings up. So let's take the first of these multiples, the PE ratio, price divided by earnings per share, right? It's the easiest, most widely used multiple in the world. Everybody seems to know what the PE ratio is. Even Anna Kournikova seemed to know what the PE ratio was. Remember Anna Kournikova? Many of you are too young to remember her, but she masqueraded as a tennis player for like a decade, won nothing, but was in every commercial you could see of. In fact, I remember a commercial she did for Charles Schwab, and I'm a Schwab account holder, and I almost canceled my account after the ad came out. And in the ad, which I'll send you a link to, it's still on Google, you can go search for it yourself, Anna's playing somebody, must have been an actress. She was actually winning. And it's the middle of a match. And I don't know why this would come up in the middle of the match, but in tennis, when every two games you switch sides, and as they're switching sides, Anna turns to this actress that she's playing and she says, price earnings ratio is price divided by earnings per share. And then she proceeded to say something about dividends that went completely over my head. So I turned off the TV and started thinking, does Anna Kournikova really know what the PE ratio is? Is it that simple? Well, the numerator is usually the current price, right? Unless you've got a technical analyst gone crazy. You know what I'm talking about? There's technical analysts love moving average prices. To which my response is, have you ever tried buying a stock at a moving average price? It's really tough to do. So the numerator is usually the current price. It's in the denominator that you get the real action, right? Because I can take the price per share today and divide by earnings per share in the most recent fiscal year, which for some companies is still 2018. Or I can divide by earnings per share in the last four quarters, which if your company just reported earnings might be through the end of 2019. But if it hasn't come out with its annual report, it might be through September of 2019. Trailing, that's called trailing PE. So if I divide by earnings per share in the most recent financial year, it's called current PE. The trailing 12 months, it's called trailing PE. I could divide price per share today by expected earnings per share in the next four quarters, which is called forward PE. Or I can divide price per share today by earnings per share in the year 2029, which is really, really forward PE. You're saying, why would I do that? Well, desperation drives you to do strange things. If you're the analyst following biotech stocks, young biotech companies, and the only tool you have is price earnings ratio, you're stymied. Every company in your sector is losing money. So you know what you do? You project out earnings into 2029. And then you tell me that a stock is cheap because it's trading at 7 times 2029 earnings. I'm not even sure what to make of it. But while I'm thinking, you sell me the stock and move on. I could divide by earnings per share before extraordinary items, after extraordinary items. I could divide by diluted earnings per share, primary earnings per share, semi-diluted earnings per share. You might not believe me, so you can try this on your own, but if you take any widely held company, you can compute 15, 20, 25 different PE ratios at a point in time, each of which technically meet the definition, but are very different numbers. I still remember computing this for Cisco a while back, and I came up with 31 different PE ratios for Cisco at a point in time, ranging from a low of 14 to a high of 29. You're saying, so what? But remember we talked about bias? Let's say I'm a biased analyst and I really want you to buy Cisco. I want to put a buy recommendation on Cisco. I have a range, right? 14 to 29. Which one of those numbers am I going to latch on to in my report? I mean, when I say Cisco is cheap and I tell you a PE ratio for Cisco, am I going to report the 14 or the 29? Think about it. If I'm bullish and I want to push a stock, I'm going to always go with the lowest number. If I'm bearish and I'm going to beat a stock down, I'm going to always go with the highest number. In fact, it's kind of funny sometimes watching two analysts on CNBC, one bullish, one bearish in a stock, talk about the same stock. And it could be something as widely held as Facebook. And they will disagree about the PE ratio for the stock. Because here's what will happen. The bearish analyst will constantly use trailing PE. The bullish analyst will constantly use forward PE. Because in periods of rising earnings, forward PE is going to give you a lower number. So here's my suggestion. If I came to you and said, you know what, this stock is cheap. It's trading at 9x earnings. Before you jump out of your seat in excitement, you know the question you need to ask me? How do you compute PE ratio? And I push back and say, well, you don't know what the PE ratio is? I thought you took a valuation class. And you couldn't tell me, well, at that point in time, you can tell me, well, Anna Kournikova might know what the PE ratio is, but I don't. Can you tell me how you computed the PE ratio? It's extremely dangerous to talk about a multiple without getting clarity on how it's computed. It's one reason why an S&P Capital IQ or any service, I don't trust any of the multiples that are computed. Not that they're doing it wrong, but if I don't know how they're doing it. So when they say PE ratio or EV to EBITDA, I don't know what they've used for the number. I'd much rather do it myself. So if I'd been making that Kournikova commercial, here's what I'd have made them do. When Anna Kournikova said PE ratio is price divided by earnings per share, I'd have made the actress she said this to turn around and say, Anna, forward earnings or trailing earnings? Because then we would have known whether Anna Kournikova really knows what the PE ratio is. But let's dig a little deeper into what it means to be consistent. Because I gave you the first level test. PE ratio passes the first level test. Numerator is an equity value. Denominator is an equity value. But now let's assume you're using PE ratios to compare across technology companies. And you're trying to come up with a consistent measure of PE ratio. And these technology companies each has options outstanding. Some have a lot, some have very little. Some have options in the money, some have options out of the money. And you're trying to come up with a PE ratio that is as you can never come up with a completely unbiased PE ratio with as little bias as you can. So you ready? So I'm comparing 30 technology companies with different numbers of options outstanding, some in the money, some out of the money, some at the money. Here are your choices to come up with the P ratio. I could use price by primary earnings per share, where I just count the actual shares. Let me stop there. If I did that, which companies are going to look cheap because I've not completely incorporated what I should factor in? Companies with a lot of options or companies with very few options? Think about it. When you have a lot of options, think of what happens. Those options are valued. They reduce your equity value. So your price is going to be lower. And if I'm dividing by your primary earnings per share, you're going to look cheap. So using P price to primary earnings per share is going to bias me towards companies with a lot of options outstanding. You're saying that's easy to fix. Let's count all options as if they were shares. That's fully diluted earnings per share. That's better, right? Well, now the danger I run into is I'm counting every option as a share, even if it's out of the money. You know what I'm going to end up finding? I'm going to end up finding that stocks with a lot of in-the-money options, deep in-the-money options, look cheap to me. So that doesn't work either. You say, what about partially diluted, where you count only in-the-money options? I could. But what if some options are $2 in the money and some are $20 in the money? So I'll give away the game. If you have lots of options outstanding, never use per share numbers. You're saying, how the heck am I going to compute PE ratio then? do it on an aggregated basis. What does that mean? In the numerator, put the market cap of the company and add to it the value of options outstanding. Remember how we computed the value of options? I know this is a mess and you don't want to deal with it, but if you have a lot of options, that's a consistent thing to do. Your numerator should include the value of your common stock plus the value of your options. And the denominator, use net income. So rather than do per share numbers, do aggregated numbers and add the value of the options in the numerator. I know it's a mess. Nobody does it that way. But the next time you see PE ratios used on a tech sector, take a look at the differences, because you might just be getting biased findings rather than findings of companies being cheap. Let's keep moving on. No, 1986, when I first started reading equity research reports, I didn't read them for fun. I just read them because I was curious. Maybe 1 in 30, 1 in 40 reports used EV to EBITDA. It's very unusual to find an equity research report built around enterprise value to EBITDA. Today, you walk into any equity research department on Wall Street and you check. About a third to 40% of the equity research is done using EV to EBITDA. It's become the most widely used multiple in equity research in many parts of the world. Now, there are some bad reasons why this has happened, maybe some good reasons, but the reality is a lot of analysts use EV to EBITDA. So often when I run into an analyst using EV to EBITDA, I ask them a simple question, because the definition of EV to EBITDA is market value of equity plus market value of debt, though many analysts cheat and use book value of debt, and they wring their hands saying it's tough to get market value, and I let that go, minus cash. In the denominator, you have earnings before interest, taxes, and depreciation. So I'm going to ask you a question, and I'll give you a minute to think about the answer, and then I'll button with the answer. Because I've asked this question of equity research analysts who use EV to EBITDA every day, and I almost never get the right answer. Why do we net cash out of the numerator? Why do we use net debt rather than gross debt? Think about it. What is it about what we're doing that leads us to net cash out? I know some of you are saying, well, it's because cash is a liquid asset. Well, maybe I should be netting out all liquid assets. And why am I just netting out cash? Why not receivables that can be collected quickly? So it's not the liquidity of cash. It's not the fact that I don't get the cash when I buy the company. When I buy a company like Apple, I get the cash as well. You know why we net cash out? It's consistency. Let me give you a clue. Look at what's in the denominator. Earnings before interest, taxes, and depreciation. We net cash out because the income from cash is not part of EBITDA. It shows up below the EBITDA line item. So we net cash out because the denominator does not include the income from cash. The numerator should not as well. And already you can see that I've opened a Pandora's box here. Because if you have cross holdings in other companies, is there something else I need to be cleaning up for? Let's say you own 10% of another company. What is it classified as? A minority holding, right? And remember what happens when you have a minority holding in another company. The income you receive on that minority holding shows up below the operating income line. In other words, it's not part of EBITDA. So you know what I need to do? If I have minority holdings, in addition to netting cash out, I need to subtract out the minority holdings in other companies. So that's with minority holdings. What if I own 60% of another company? Lead me through what's going to happen to your EV to EBITDA. The market value of equity reflects the 60% that you own of company B, right? Because markets are not stupid. They don't consolidate. They say you own 60% of company B. We'll include that in market value of equity. Okay. Market value of debt, cash, and EBITDA all come from your financials, which are consolidated. You're saying, what does that mean? Well, your debt, cash, and EBITDA, you're acting as if you have 100% of the subsidiary. So in other words, you got a mismatch. Your market value of equity includes only the 60% of company B you own, but the debt, cash, and EBITDA, you're counting 100%. So how do you fix that? Two ways, right? One is if you can somehow bring in the 40% of equity that doesn't belong to you and add it to your numerator, the problem will go away, right? So is there something that captures that 40% that doesn't belong to you on a financial statement? Yeah, it's called minority interest or non-controlling interest. So you know what analysts often do? They take market value of equity, they add the non-controlling interest. Add because you want to bring the 40% in. This way you have 100% equity, though you created a bit of a mess because that non-controlling interest or minority interest is a book value number. You brought it into a market value number. But at least you've gotten rid of the inconsistency. So that's one way to do it, is to strip, is to bring in the 40% that doesn't belong to you, and everything is now 100%. You know what the other way to do this is? Go purely to parent company financials. In other words, subtract out the 60% of the subsidiary that doesn't belong to you from the market value of equity. Subtract out the 100% of debt, cash, and EBITDA that belongs to the subsidiary. Everything goes back to steady state. But the key is to make sure you're consistent. You know what? This is a gigantic problem if you're an analyst in Asia or Latin America. Imagine trying to compute the EV to EBITDA for SoftBank. What's SoftBank's biggest single holding? Alibaba, right? And Alibaba alone accounts for 25% of SoftBank's market value of equity. If I do not adjust for that, I'm going to come up with a really high EV to EBITDA for SoftBank because my numerator will include 25% of the 25% that SoftBank gets from Alibaba, but my denominator, because it's a minority holding, will reflect none of the income or the EBITDA from Alibaba. So pick a cross-holding company and you're going to see the problem you were trying to run away from by using pricing. The one reason you didn't want to use DCF was you said, I don't want to deal with that cross-holding problem. It's chasing you down. Let's move to a fourth example. In this example, what I have is a housing price multiple. You said housing has a multiple? Well, one of the problems with real estate often is the fact that real estate is, you know, you can get bubbles and busts and you don't even know you're in a bubble. So you'd like to know when you're in a bubble. And one measure that some real estate people have devised is to take the market price of a house and divide by annual rental income. Let me explain. Let's assume the market price of your house, and this could be a residential house. You live in New York, New Jersey, you have $1 million house. Let's say that the annual rental income you could get on this house is $60,000, $5,000 a month. You take the million divided by 60,000, you get a multiple, right? 16.67. That's a housing price to annual rental income. And the way these people who look at real estate use it is they look at it across time and say, historically, the price has been 14 times rental income. Now it's 17 times rental income or 20 times rental income. So housing is overpriced. But let's say you decide to use this differently. Let's assume you want to decide whether housing is under or overpriced relative to stocks. Okay, see what you're trying to do. So you're looking at housing and you're looking at stocks and say, which one is more underpriced relative to the other? So you've computed the housing price to rental income and the annual net rental income is basically netting out the expenses associated with renting the house, which might be the maintenance, the landscaping, the property taxes. So you take the housing price to annual rental income and you're trying to compare it to some ratio in the equity market that is analogous. So you want to be consistent. So here's my question. If I wanted to compare the housing price to annual rental income in real estate to a multiple in stocks, should I compare it to PE ratios, EV to sales, EV to EBITDA, or EV to EBIT? You see what I'm trying to say? I want to make sure they're both being consistent. So think about it for a moment. So let's decide price or EV. What do you think I should compare it to? A pricing price to an equity multiple or an enterprise multiple? How do you answer that? You look at what's in the numerator of your real estate multiple, right? What is in the numerator? The entire price of the house, as opposed to what? The equity portion of the house. You might have put in only 30% of that price. I'm looking at the entire price of the house. So already you can see you don't want to use an equity multiple. So cross out the PE ratio. It's definitely not PE. Now comes the second question. What's annual net rental income closest to? Is it closest to sales? Is it closest to EBITDA? Or is it closest to EBIT? Well, sales is kind of a messy concept, so I would not think of it as sales. Is it more like EBITDA or EBIT? It's annual net rental income, right? So it's before taxes and before, if you rented the house out, you might be able to depreciate it. So it's before both taxes and depreciation. So we've kind of reasoned our way to an answer, right? If you're looking at price to annual net rental income, the multiple that I think makes the most sense to compare it to is EV to EBITDA. You know, the EV to EBITDA for the market is right now, it's about 8 to 9. So the question is, when you're looking at housing price to annual rental income, are you getting a much higher number? And if so, should you view that as an indication that housing is overpriced relative to stocks? I'll let you wrestle with that question, but at least we've talked about the consistency issue. So I'll let I know. And so think about those consistency questions. And in fact, the next multiple you look at, make sure it's consistently defined. Let's move on to the descriptive test. Sounds fancy, right? But here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play Moneyball. For Moneyball, for those of you who don't know, is one of my favorite movies. It's a book written by Michael Lewis about a guy called Billy Bean, who used to be, still is, the manager of the Oakland A's. The Oakland A's are a small budget team. You know, baseball is a very unfair sport. You know, the Yankees have a huge budget because, not because they draw a lot of people to the stadium. That's not the reason. It's because they have a big TV contract. In contrast, football is a much more even sport because the TV contracts are shared across the teams. But baseball, you have rich teams and you have poor teams. So the Seattle Mariners and the Oakland A's can never draw in as much money as the Los Angeles Dodgers, the Boston Red Sox, or the New York Yankees. So for a long time, low budget or small budget teams have had to struggle. So Billy Bean was hired as a manager of the Oakland A's, you know, a long time ago, 20 plus years ago. And he came in, he was a young guy, you know, I don't know where he went to school, but he had a background in statistics. He came in as a manager of a baseball team. Now, for those of you who don't know baseball, it's a team with a lot of history in the US. And for a long time, all these rules of thumb were developed in baseball. If this happens and this is true, and the way in which baseball teams decided which players to sign and how much to pay them was they had scouts. These old men, usually, I don't think there were any old women scouts, but maybe there should have been old men, who'd been around baseball for a long time. And they'd come to a manager and say, you know what, this guy's going to be a great pitcher. He has a crooked arm. And I saw somebody with a crooked arm 37 years ago, and he turned out to be Sandy Koufax, who was one of the greatest pitchers of all time. And so Billy Bean came in and he had scouts like everybody else. And he noticed after a while that the scouts seemed to have no idea what they were talking about. They're a little bit like market strategists, have no idea, but they sounded good. So after a while, he said, why am I listening to these guys? Baseball is a sport with an incredible amount of data. Why don't I let the data tell me what's working and what's not? I'll give you a simple example of how he used the data. I mean, if you don't quite understand baseball, this is going to kind of fly over you, but you can translate into any other sport. So baseball, one of the big deals is you want to get on base and you want to score. So the way historically scouts measured whether you should sign a player was by how many hits he got and how good he was at hitting. But Billy Bean said, well, it's not just hitting. If you walk, you get to first base as well, because walk basically means you get four balls and you get to first base. And he looked at the statistics and he noticed a guy called Kevin Youkilis. Now, for those of you Boston Red Sox fans, I hate Kevin Youkilis because I'm a Yankee fan. No, but Billy Bean saw Kevin Youkilis and he said, you know what, this guy gets on base all the time. He called him the Greek god of walks, because Kevin is Greek and you walk, a Greek god of walks, you get it, right? So that's just a little, and he, of course, became a Major League Baseball player that the A's were able to trade to the Red Sox for a price. So what Billy Bean said was he was going to use the data because he was sick and tired of rules of thumb that don't work. You know how close that is to what we run into in pricing? Because think about all the rules of thumb built around multiples. I'll give you a few. A price to book ratio less than one is cheap. A PEG ratio less than one is cheap. A price earnings ratio less than 10 is cheap. EV to EBITDA less than six is cheap. Who makes up this stuff? So in a sense, we have scouts in investing and none of the things I suggest seem to work, but we have a lot of data, which right now we're not using. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the data and see if there are answers there that I can use to debunk some of these rules of thumb and perhaps price things better. In fact, as you look at these distributions, I'm going to show you, because what I'm going to do is pure statistics. I'm going to go look at every company's PE ratio, and then I'm going to put it up in a distribution called a histogram. So you can see what the shape of the distribution is. You can look at the 10th percentile, the first quartile, the median, the third quartile, the 90th percentile. You can slice and dice the data. Along the way, I'm going to talk about what happens when you cannot estimate a multiple. You're saying, what are you talking about? When can you not estimate PE ratio? When the earnings are negative. We're going to talk about the biases that are created when you cannot estimate a multiple. And by looking at the data, I can also look at trends over time. So you ready? At the start of every year, here's what I do. I take every publicly traded company in the world. I compute every multiple I can for every company. Sounds like a lot of work, but remember, the raw data comes from Capital IQ. I just compute the multiple, P ratio, price to book, EV to sales, EV to EBITDA, EV to invested capital. And then I create histograms. And the histograms are just very simply, I count the number of companies with the P ratio less than 4, 4 to 8, 8 to 12. So this is my histogram for US stocks at the start of 2020. You're saying, why are there three different columns? The first is my current P, price divided by most recent earnings per share. Remember on January 1st, 2020, when I did this, the most recent year for almost for every company in my sample was probably 2018, the calendar year, because the 2019 numbers didn't come out till two months later. The second is the trailing P, which is through September of 2019 for most companies. And the purple is the forward P, based upon the expected earnings per share in the next four quarters. Before I show you the descriptive statistics, take a look at this histogram. What's the first thing that jumps out at you? It's not symmetric, right? You're saying, what's the big deal? So much of what we do in business and investing is built around the assumption of normality. The very fact that we use standard deviations is a dead giveaway, right? Because standard deviations work really well in a normal distribution. They don't work that well with an asymmetric or a skewed distribution. This is an asymmetric or a skewed distribution. But I'll tell you why it matters with multiples. I remember my statistics class, my statistics professor getting up and saying, if you have an asymmetric distribution, never trust the average. And I remember listening, saying, what is he talking about? Remember what the average is? Basically, I add up all the numbers and divide by the number of firms. When you have a skewed distribution, first, let's think about why PE ratios can never be symmetrically distributed. What's the lowest value a PE ratio can have? Zero, right? What's the highest value it can have? God only knows. Your outliers are all big positive numbers. So when I compute the average PE ratio for a market or a sector, guess what? The outliers are all big positive numbers. They're going to pull the average out. In fact, you're saying, how much can it matter? Here's what the numbers look like at the start of 2020. Let's take the current PE. There were 7,082 companies. This is just the US. Now I'll show you the global distribution in a minute. There were 7,082 companies in my sample, but I was able to get PE ratios only for 2,948. Let me pause right there. Why did I lose 5,200 firms, roughly speaking? What happened to them? I couldn't compute the PE ratio. You're saying, why? Because the earnings per share were negative. And this is before the crisis. Can you imagine what this is going to look like in 2020? It's going to be decimation. I would be surprised if more than 1,000 out of the 7,100 companies had positive earnings in 2020. 2019, no, I lost. And this was a good year. I lost more than two-thirds of my sample. You're saying, what's the big deal? You still have 2,948 companies. You're right. I have 2,948 companies. It's a big sample. But one of the things in statistics is when you throw items out of your sample, you got to be careful you're not creating bias. Am I creating bias by throwing out companies with negative earnings? I think so. I'm throwing out the most distressed, the youngest, the riskiest, the highest growth companies and computing the PE ratio over the rest. It's a constant problem when you use multiples is when you lose a lot of companies, you create bias in your sample. Nothing I can do about it though with PE ratios. So here's what I did. I computed all of the descriptive statistics. I started with the simple average. Is added up the numbers, divide by 2,948, 60.52. Think about it. The average PE for US stocks at the start of 2020 was 60.52. Mind-bogglingly high, right? But the median PE was only 18. You're saying, how do you explain the difference? Look at the company with the highest PE, 9,181. In fact, with trailing P, the highest P I got was 41,200. I think that must be one highly priced stock. Not really. The earnings per share had dropped to a fraction of a cent. You know, the lesson I get out of this is often you hear people saying, well, I think this stock is cheap because it's trading at less than the average P for the sector or the market. And I have only one counter question. What's your median PE? Because the median is a much more meaningful number when you have an asymmetric distribution. The 10th percentile, which is, so if you ask me what's a really low PE for US stocks at the start of 2020, that's about 7. The first quartile is still pretty low, only 25% stocks, about 12. So if you ask me at the start of 2020, what would a low PE look like for a US stock? I'd say about 12, maybe 11. And it's not a rule of thumb. It's based on what the numbers tell me at the start of 2020. What will it look like at the end of start of 2021? What will the cheap stock be? Well, I'll have to look at the distribution then. Make your distribution the basis for your rules of thumb rather than absolute numbers. In fact, here's one final point before we leave this table. Notice that as I go from current PE to trailing PE to forward PE, I lose another 550 firms. Why is that? Why do I lose more companies when I go to forward PE? It's not because I was perceptive and I could see the coronavirus creating havoc to earnings. You know why I lost about 550 firms? To get forward PE, what do I need? I need expected earnings in the next four quarters. There is no way. I'm sitting estimating expected earnings for 7,082 companies. So you know what I look for, right? An analyst estimate of earnings for the next four quarters. So when a company is not tracked by analysts, I lose it in my sample. You create bias in the most subtle ways, in the multiples you choose and how you compute them. Just be aware of it. You can't make it go away. Now, until about 15 years ago, I used to compute this distribution only for US stocks. Then I'd end up in Sao Paulo or Mumbai and I'd show that picture. Remember the asymmetric picture, peak to the left, tail to the right. And some grizzled old analyst, you know, would put up his hand and say, it doesn't look anything like that in the Sensex or in India. And I'd say, how do you know? You know what he means, but not anything like that. He says, oh, I don't think in India you get a peak to the left and a tail to the right. So how do you know? And the reaction I'd get almost invariably was gut feeling. And after about the fifth or sixth time of being told that the gut feeling of a Brazilian and Indian Indonesian analyst was that stocks in India, Indonesia, Brazil didn't look like that, I said, you know what? I'm sick and tired of your trusting your gut feeling. So starting about 15 years ago, I started doing this globally. So until 15 years ago, everything I did was just US stocks. I think starting 2003 or so, I went global. So in the last few years, in addition to doing the distribution for US stocks, I do the distribution by region of the world. So this is my one page capture. This is the page I keep with me whenever somebody says, is this stock cheap or expensive? And you're going to see in a minute why it'll help you. I break the world down into sub-regions. I've not done the distribution for all of them because you have too many columns. First, if you look across parts of the world, and here I have US, emerging markets, Europe, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and global. Every single distribution, notice the peak is to the left, the tail is to the right. Stocks across the world have more in common than we realize. Does that mean that you can just use them across the board? Not necessarily, because if you look by subgroup, the median PEs obviously are very different. You're saying, how do I use this? Well, if you just look based on the median PE, the cheapest stocks in the world are in Eastern Europe and Russia, median PE of 10.49. Don't go do anything crazy and go put all your money in East European and Russian stocks, because there's a good reason why the PE ratio is low, right? And what is it? They're riskier. The most expensive stocks in the world at the start of 2020 were in China, 25, followed by the US. And I've given you the distributional characteristics. Notice there are 44,420 companies in my overall sample. And I've also listed out the percentage of companies that I lose because they're money losing. The US has the highest, as one of the highest percentages. But Australia and Canada had a very high percentage of money losing companies in 2019. You know why, right? Australia and Canada tend to be dominated by natural resource companies. And natural resource companies have had a tough few years. 2020, it's going to look even worse for natural resource companies. So this one table turns out to be really useful, because if you come to me with, let's say, a Japanese stock with a PE ratio of 15 and say, tell me, is a 15 a high or a low? I can just go to Japan, look across, 15 puts me close to the median, say, you know what, at 15 times earnings, you're roughly around average. Whereas if that same stock with a 15 times PE were in Eastern Europe or Russia, it would be expensive. Whereas in the US, it could be cheaper. So you can already see definitions of what cheaper, expensive will vary across markets. Now, the other advantage is sometimes when you have big differences across markets, that can be information. This is from my 2013 update where I was looking at price to book ratios, because I do these histograms pretty much every multiple. Now, and I broke them down by big regions of the world. Notice the standout at the start of 2013, Japan, the median stock was trading at about 2/3 book value. Part of that is accounting traditions in Japan kept book value up. The other was Japanese stocks were really cheap. In 2013, Japan was the best performing market in the world. And maybe if I looked at this graph as a pricer and invested based on the graph, I could have made money on that mispricing. And finally, as I said, this is a classic way in which you can debunk rules of thumb. For instance, one rule of thumb that you will hear is 6x EBITDA is cheap. I remember being on a panel with a private equity investor a while back, and we were talking about a company he'd invested in. And I said, well, it looks like you paid a lot. You know, it looks like you paid a high price for the company. He says, no, the stock was cheap. And I said, what do you base that on? He said, oh, it's a very simple rule. It's less than 6x EBITDA, it has to be cheap. I said, is that simple? And here's the simplest reason to kind of counter anybody who says 6x EBITDA is cheap or 10x earnings is cheap. Just go back and count the number of companies that trade at less than 6x EBITDA. In 2010, if somebody told me 6x EBITDA is cheap, I'd have counted by saying half of all stocks in the US trade at less than 6x EBITDA. Well, 6x EBITDA being cheap might work in 2020 because the medians for EV to EBITDA multiples have all shifted upwards, unless you happen to be in Eastern Europe or Russia or Japan, where the multiples tend to be lower, or India, where the EBITDA multiples tend to be lower. So you can already see the usefulness of having the data available to you. And you have the data. We have no excuses. This is in 1965. We said, oh, that's a lot of data. How will I collect it? It's on Capital IQ, and you have access to it. Is have the data available, you can counter most rules of thumb. So define, describe, let's analyze the multiple. When you look at a multiple, no matter what multiple it is, there are two questions you need to answer. One is, what are the fundamentals that drive these multiples? I know that we're pricing things and fundamentals go into the backseat, but they're still there. What are the variables that drive this multiple? And I'm going to give you a very simple mechanism for identifying the variables that drive any multiple. And then I'm going to have a follow-up question. How, as those variables change, will the multiple change? So let me give you an example, a preview. I'm going to show you that the price earnings ratio is driven by three variables: growth, payout, and cost of equity. That's it, three variables. So I'll show you how I got the three, but I'm also going to show you that as growth increases, PE will increase, but I'm going to be explicit about how much. You're saying, why do I need to know that? Let's say you're trying to pick a stock, a price of stock based on the PE ratio of 20 companies, you're comparing them. Some have high growth, some have low growth, some have high risk, some have low risk. I've told you the three variables you need to control for when you use that multiple. And I'm also going to give you a sense of how much they will affect your multiple. Otherwise, how can you ever price stocks, right? Because you're going to get stuck. So let's look at the construct for identifying the variables that determine each multiple. Here's a simple mechanism. If you have an equity multiple, like price earnings ratio, price to book ratio, go back to the simplest version of an equity valuation model that you can think of. The simplest one I can think of is a dividend discount model, where I take expected dividends next year divided by cost of equity minus the growth rate. The R is the cost of equity. Now you're saying, how does that help me? Let's suppose I want to find the variables that determine price to book. I divide my equity valuation model, both sides of the equation, by the book value. So price divided by book is my price to book ratio. Earnings divided by book is return equity. I now have an equation for price to book ratio. Don't worry about the equation. The equation itself is a very simplistic stable growth dividend discount model, but I've identified the variables that drive the price to book. It's return equity, payout, cost of equity, and growth rate. And so with every multiple, I'm going to do the equation and say, when I look at price to book ratios, these are the variables I need to control for: difference in return equity, differences in risk and cost of equity, differences in growth, differences in payout. I can do this with any equity multiple. If you have an enterprise value multiple, go back to the simplest enterprise value model you can think of, which is stable growth free cash flow of the firm. Remember, free cash flow of the firm can be written as EBIT times 1 minus D, after tax operating income, times 1 minus the reinvestment rate. This is a simpler version of free cash flow of the firm divided by cost of capital minus the growth rate. So if I want to get EV to sales, I divide both sides of that equation by sales. I get EV to sales on the left side. If I divide after-tax operating income by sales, I get after-tax operating margin. And like magic, I can tell you the variables that drive EV to sales are after-tax operating margin, reinvestment rate, cost of capital, and growth rate. It's a very clever trick. Equity multiples go back to an equity model. Enterprise value multiples go back to a firm valuation model. So let's zone in on PE ratios, most widely used multiple in the world. We might as well understand what drives it. To see what drives the PE ratio, I'm going to go back to a stable growth dividend discount model. I know it's very simplistic, very narrow, but I'm doing this just for the algebra, to keep my algebra simple. If I divide both sides of that equation by earnings per share, price divided by earnings per share is PE, dividends divided by earnings per share is payout. But since it's next year's dividends, I have a 1 plus G in the numerator, divided by R minus G. If you don't like dividends, because let's face it, companies don't always pay out what they can afford to dividends, you can replace dividends with free cash or equity. And all that will mean is your payout ratio, instead of being the actual payout ratio, would be a potential payout ratio, free cash or equity divided by earnings. So the variables that drive PE are payout ratio or quasi-payout ratio, growth, and cost of equity. And you can already see the dynamics, right? Holding all else constant, if I increase G, my PE will go up. Higher growth companies should have higher PE ratios. If holding all else constant, if I increase R, the cost of equity, my PE ratio should go down. Higher risk companies should have lower PE ratios. And holding all else constant, keeping growth especially constant, if I can pay out more, in other words, I'm earning a higher return in equity, I should have a higher PE ratio. High returns in equity will translate to high PE. High risk will translate into low PE. High growth will translate into high PE. I'm going to give you a very simple way you can use this to screen for stocks. But before I do that, let me expand on this equation. The equation I just showed you is a very simplistic equation. It's for a stable growth dividend paying firm. You're saying, what if I have a high growth company like Cisco or Zoom? How would I use this? Well, there's a two-stage version of a dividend discount model I can use, which I'm sure you've never seen because we always do two-stage models on Excel spreadsheets. But if I wrote that equation out as a math equation, here's what I would have. I would have the value of the stock is the present value expected dividends during the high growth phase. That's what this first term in the equation is. It's the present value of a growing annuity. So if you have 10 years of growth, this is the present value of dividends during those 10 years. And at the end of the 10 years, what do you have? You have the terminal value. So the second term is the terminal value. So I've just taken what we usually do in an Excel spreadsheet and made one equation. I don't know whether you remember high school calculus, but I'm going to test you a little bit, at least on what you can remember. One of the things I said we'd like to know is how will the PE ratio change as growth rate changes? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this equation, divide both sides by earnings per share. And if I do, I end up with the PE ratio for a high growth firm. And guess what it's a function of? Payout ratio, cost of equity, and growth rate. Exactly the same three variables I had with the stable growth model. This is incredibly good news. You know why? Because when you have to identify the variables that drive a multiple, you can go to the simplest model and use it to extract the variables and then move on. We're not using these equations to estimate the PE ratio. We're using these equations to see what we need to control for when we use PE ratios. Remember I said high school calculus will come in handy? One of the questions we'd like to answer is how will the PE change as the growth changes, right? I've given you an equation for PE ratio and there's a growth on the right-hand side. So what am I asking for? You're asking for in calculus terms. If I want to find out how PE will change as growth changes, all I have to do is take the first differential of that equation, right? Don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to do it because I know some of you have rusty calculus. But you can actually, if you're mathematically inclined, take that equation and ask all kinds of what-if questions. So now I'm going to use that expanded version to do a very simple hypothetical example. This is a high-growth company with 25% growth for the next 5 years and 8% thereafter. It's going to have a payout ratio of 20% for the next 5 years and a payout ratio of 50%. Why higher after 5 years? Well, if your growth rate is lower, you should be able to pay out more. For simplicity, I'm going to keep the beta the same. I could have let the beta change as well. So here's my question, and it's a very simple one. I've given you the characteristics of the company, that fundamental. It's basically for a dividend discount model. And for the moment, let's assume your cost of equity is 11.5%. I want you to estimate an intrinsic PE ratio for your company. You're saying, what's an intrinsic PE ratio? It's what you would get if you used a dividend discount model to value the company. Well, here's what I did. I went to the previous page, I took the equation and I plugged in the numbers. 20% payout ratio, 25% growth rate, 11.5% cost of equity. There's my high growth phase. Don't worry that the denominator is negative because whenever the denominator is negative, the numerator will also be negative and you'll still get a positive present value. Trust me on that one. The second term in the equation is the present value of your terminal price. 8% growth forever, 11.5% cost of equity, 50% payout ratio. If I plug the numbers and work them through, the PE ratio that I get for this firm is 28.75. You're saying, what does that mean? If this stock were trading at its intrinsic value, what the two-stage dividend discount model would tell you the value was, it should be trading at 28.75 times earnings. You're saying, but I want to do pricing. Why am I going back to a two-stage dividend discount model? You're right. I don't want to use a two-stage dividend discount model to actually price the stock, but I'm going to do some what-ifs. Let's say you decide to pay 28.75 times earnings for this stock. That's a high PE, right? Why are you willing to pay a high PE? Because you expect high growth. So what's your nightmare scenario when you pay a high PE ratio for a high growth stock? Well, that you could wake up tomorrow with a surprise. With a surprise where your growth is actually much lower than expected, right? So let's make that surprise come true. Here's what I did. I took the PE ratio as a function of the growth rate. You're saying, why are there four columns? I've looked at four interest rate scenarios, 4%, 6%, 8%, 10%. Actually, I made up this example 20 years ago where 4% seemed like a low interest rate. I should have really created a 2% and a 0%. But you get pretty much the sense of dynamics of what's going to happen. In every interest rate scenario, as my expected growth, so this is a growth during the first 5 years, as my growth surprise leads me to expect more growth. Remember, my base was 25%. If I get higher growth than expected, my PE ratio is going to be higher. If I have lower growth than expected, my PE ratio is going to be lower. You're saying, big deal. I knew that already. Why do I need an example to get this home? But I give you four interest rate scenarios, right? So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. Under which interest rate scenario is my PE ratio most sensitive to changes in my growth rate? You get that question? Under which interest rate scenario, low or high, is my PE ratio most sensitive to changes in my growth rate? The blue is my low interest rate scenario. The green is my high. Under which scenario is my PE most sensitive? Well, it looks like the blue is more sensitive, right? Look at how much it moves as the growth. In fact, as your risk-free rate increases, the effect of higher growth seems to be smaller. Why might that be? Why, as interest rates get higher, am I getting less affected by growth surprises? What's the value of growth? It's all in the future, right? Let me create a fifth scenario and say a risk-free rate of 1,000%. Let's put ourselves in Venezuela. What's the value of, let's say you have 25% growth. What's the value of 25% growth for the next 5 years if your risk-free rate is 1,000%? Close to zero, right? What if I surprise you and say the growth will be higher? You say, I don't care. As risk-free rates increase, the value of growth decreases and the effect of a surprise gets smaller. Again, this might sound like an abstraction, but you know how you get these earnings surprises? How do companies deliver earnings surprises? In earnings announcements. This table should give you some insight into how stock prices would react to earnings announcements. For instance, right now, are we in a low interest rate environment or a high interest rate environment? I don't think there's any surprise that we're in a low interest rate environment, right? So if you believe this graph, a given earnings surprise in this market should have a much bigger effect on the stock price than an earnings surprise 10 years ago, 20 years ago. It's not like markets have become more inefficient. It's just they'll become more volatile. Think of this as the dark side of really low risk-free rates is price reactions are going to get more extreme to surprises because the effect of that surprise on growth is going to show up as a much bigger change in value. I also looked at what would happen to the PE ratio of that hypothetical firm as I changed my beta. Remember my base example at a beta of one, I changed it all the way up to two. And with every single growth example, so this is a growth rate in the first 5 years, ranging from 25 to 8%. As I increase my beta, my PE ratio comes down. But again, let's make this real. Let's assume you're a high growth firm, 20% growth with a beta of two. So right now you're here, you're trading at about eight times earnings and you're disappointed. You want your PE ratio to increase. And you have two choices. You can either go for more growth, in which case, where are you stuck? You still have a beta of two. You're stuck in this last set of bars. Or you can go for less risk. Where do you think the payoff is greater? It looks to me like the payoff for going for less risk is much greater than the payoff for going more, for more growth. And that's obvious, but sometimes high growth companies forget this. They get so focused on growth and growth and still more growth that they forget that sometimes reducing risk can have a much bigger impact on the PE ratios and stock prices. It's a reminder that this is a multidimensional game. You should never get focused on just one dimension like growth and completely forget the others. So I'm going to use the insights we got from that analysis of P ratio, because remember, P ratio is a function of growth, risk, and payout slash return equity. I'm going to give you a very simple way in which to look for cheap stocks on a pricing basis. So we're not doing valuation, we're doing pricing. So you're going to use PE ratios to find cheap stocks. So first you want a low PE, right? Now I'm going to list variable by variable, and I want you to tell me what you want for your cheap stock, for that stock to stay cheap. So you want nothing to explain away the low PE. So you want low growth or high growth? Think about it for a moment. If you have low growth, it explains away the PE. So you want something that is truly cheap and you want to invest in, you want low PE and you want high growth, not low growth. Okay, you're catching on? Low risk or high risk? Well, you want low risk. Otherwise, you know, you explain it. So you want PE ratio, low PE, high growth, low risk. You want low return on equity or high return equity? Or you want a high return equity. So you want a low PE, a high growth, low risk, and high return equity. You're saying, what chance do I have of finding something like that? Well, there's no harm looking, right? There are 43,000 stocks on Capital IQ. Who knows? Maybe you get lucky. That is what you do when you do screening. So when you go into Capital IQ and you say, how do I screen for cheap stocks? Look for low PE, high growth, low risk, and high return equity. Okay. And you might have to tweak the numbers on the screens, but that's exactly what screening is. So let's use that insight. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to play the role of a very naive equity research analyst. And I want you to shoot me down repeatedly and point out what I might be forgetting with the pitch I'm making. So here's my first one. I come to you with a bunch of emerging markets. So there they are. And this is March of 2014, just before Russia invaded Ukraine. So I tell you, Russia looks cheap. Look at, so at the lowest PE ratio. It does look cheap, right? Lowest PE ratio. But this is a very simple one. So I put out a buy recommendation. Buy all Russian stocks, they're cheap, low PE. What is it that I'm missing? Think about it. It's growth, risk, and return equity. Well, the key variable that stands out with Russia, at least in 2014, is it's a much riskier company. So it's risk. It's high risk. I'm not saying it's going to tell you what to do, but it's a question you're going to raise when I say Russia looks cheap. You can say, but Russia is risky. You say, how does that help me? I'm going to give you a tool where we can take this insight and convert it into an actual pricing mechanism. So this is from a long time ago, June of 2000. I pulled up the PE ratios for about 15 emerging markets. So you can see the PE ratios in the second column. And I also pulled up numbers on interest rates, real growth, and country risk. Again, I'm going to give you some insight into why this matters. So holding all else constant, as interest rates go up in a country, what should happen to the PE ratio? Think about it. One of the inputs in the PE ratio is the cost of equity, right? As interest rates rise, the cost of equity goes up. As the cost of equity goes up, the PE ratio should go down. So higher interest rates should translate into lower PE ratios. What about growth? You want, when as growth goes up, what should happen to PE? Well, it should go up as well. And as risk goes up, PE ratio should go down. So keep that in mind, because I'm going to put out a buy recommendation. This is June of 2000 on Turkish stocks. They look really cheap, 12 times earnings. So pushback. What's the first problem with Turkish stocks? Well, if you look at interest rates, Turkey has really high interest rates, really low growth, and pretty high risk, right? Already you can see the problem with storytelling. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to open up my statistics book to the chapter on multiple regressions. Remember, in a multiple regression, you have a dependent variable and independent variables. The dependent variable here is the PE ratio, and the three independent variables are interest rates, real growth in GDP, and country risk. I ran the regression. I got an R squared of 73%. That's a pretty good R squared. It's a small sample, so I'm not going to get too excited. But let's look at the coefficients and see if they make sense. Higher interest rate, lower PE ratio. That makes sense. The higher the interest rate, for every 1% increase in interest rates, the PE ratio decreases. Higher growth in GDP, higher PE ratio. Higher, that makes sense as well. And higher country risk, lower PE ratio. That makes sense as well. You're saying, why are you checking to see if it makes sense? Because when you run these regressions, as you will be on some of your companies, don't expect the data to always act according to your plans. Here, I got lucky. Every single coefficient is in the right direction. They are always statistically significant. You know what that means, right? I checked the T statistics. I know this is a throwback in time to statistic class, but if your t-statistics are greater than 2, they're statistically significant. So the regression actually looked like it was explaining differences in peas. He's saying, how is this going to help me decide whether turkey is cheap or expensive? What if I went into my sample and plugged in each stock's interest rate, growth, and country risk into the regression? So I plug in Argentina's interest rate, growth, and country risk. I'll get a predicted PE for Argentina, and I do that for each country. That's exactly what I did in the next table. The last column, if you plug in the interest rates, growth, and country risk into the regression you saw on the previous page, my predicted PE for Argentina is 13.57. At 14 times earnings, it looked cheap, but after I control for the differences of growth and risk, it's actually expensive because my actual PE is higher. Brazil at 21 times PE is expensive, but the predicted PE is 81. It's even more expensive than I thought it was. With each market, I get a predicted PE. Notice that Hong Kong at 20 times earnings looked expensive relative to the other markets, but after I control for the low risk at that time and the high growth, its predicted PE should be 23. And if you take Turkey with its numbers, my predicted PE is 13.35. It's trading at 12 times earnings. It is cheap, but not as cheap as I thought it was. What I've done is I've not turned things over to statistics, but used it to statistical tool to control for differences. Let's build on that proposition because by now you kind of get a sense of what I'm trying to do. So let's take US stocks collectively. I talked earlier in pretty demeaning terms about market strategies because I think most of them are full of, you know what. But in a sense, what I've done here is done what a market strategist does. So I'm going to play the role of a market strategist and you tell me what I might be missing. So this is the start of 2020. I've graphed out the PE ratios for the last almost 50 years, actually 50 years. So I've graphed out 4 different PE ratios. The first is trailing PE, the level of the S&P 500 divided by the earnings per share in the most recent year. The second is a normalized PE, where I take the price today and divide by the average earnings by over the last 10 years. The third is what's called a K. It's a K Pinchula PE are very close. They use both averaging across time and inflation adjustments. It's a little fancier. And finally, I've computed what's called a T-bond PE, and I'll come back and talk about it for a moment. But basically, in this graph, I've shown you just the stock PE ratios. So you ready? I'm going to play the role of a market strategist. January 1st, 2020, I tell you, US stocks are overpriced. Why? Because the PE ratio today, take a look at the start of 2020, the PE ratio today, using every definition of PE, from traditional PE to Cape to Shiller PE, is much higher than the PE ratio has been for the last 50 years, 10 years, 20 years. So stocks are overpriced because the PE ratio today is higher than it's been. I would look incredibly, foresighted now if I'd made this prediction. But I think it's very shallow. In fact, this is the prediction I've heard in 8 out of the last 12 years about US stocks. They're overpriced. Why? Because the PE ratio today is much higher than it's been historically. So I want you to push back. It is true that the PE ratio at the start of 2020 is higher than the historical average. But tell me, what might explain it other than stocks being overpriced? Think about the inputs into that PE ratio equation: cost of equity, growth, and return equity. What goes into cost of equity? What are the two components in a cost? Especially if you're looking at the entire market, there's no beta. So it's risk-free rate plus equity risk premium, right? So what's been true about interest rates over the last 10 years, especially as you get into 2020? They've been really low. So one obvious explanation for why PE ratios are much higher than they've been historically is the T-bond rate is so low. So what I started doing a few years ago was computing a PE ratio for T-bonds. You say, how can a T-bond have a PE? Well, it's very simple. The coupon becomes your earnings. The price of the bond becomes the price. So the brown line is the T-bond PE. And notice that in the last decade, you could actually make the argument that stocks are not expensive. They're cheap relative to T-bonds. I know it's a relative statement, but all of pricing is relative. So my problem with stocks are cheap or expensive based just on the PE is you're not factoring in the things you need to. At the minimum, you need to bring in the level of interest rates, but you can't stop there. It could be differences in growth. If you're on the verge of high growth, your PE ratio should be higher. It could be return equity. If your companies are delivering much higher returns in equity, your PE should be higher. So you need to go through those same list of questions, even if you look at an index. So I'm going to complete this US example by doing something that I find useful. So what I do is I invert the P ratio. It's called the earnings yield. It's earnings divided by price. The blue line is the earnings to price ratio. The brown is the T-bond rate. Already you can see if I just stopped and showed you those two lines, over time they've tended to move together. When T-bond rates are high, the earnings to price ratio is high. When T-bond rates are low, the earnings to price ratio is low. Remember, earnings to price ratio is low means price earnings ratio high. You've got inverted. So what's the third line at the bottom, the zigzag? That gray line is the difference between the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate. It's a measure of the slope of the yield curve. When that number is very large and positive, you've got an upward sloping yield curve. When that number is zero, you've got a flat yield curve. When that number is negative, you've got a downward sloping yield curve. You're saying, who cares? You're going to see in a minute that it might matter. So here's what I did. I did a correlation between the earnings to price ratio and the T-bond rate. No surprise, the two moved together. You saw that in the graph. I also did a correlation between earnings to price and the slope of the yield curve. And there, the more upward sloping the yield curve, the lower the earnings to price ratio. Remember, low earnings to price means high price earnings ratios. So why would having an upward sloping yield curve give you higher price earnings ratios? Think about it, right? You know, the conventional wisdom with yield curves is when they're upward sloping, they're predicting high growth in the future. When they're flat or downward sloping, you're gonna have a recession or negative growth. So maybe what we're capturing here is a growth proxy. So I took those years of data, 50 years of data, and I ran a regression of earnings to price ratios. This is called a time series regression. I'm just looking at the S&P 500 over time, regressing the earnings to price ratio against the T-bond rate and the difference between the T-bond and the T-bill rate. Whenever you see me run a regression and you see these numbers as coefficients, those are not computed numbers. They come as output from the regression. So let's read the output. The base was 0.0373. That's telling me very little. That's a base from which I'm going to build up. Every 1% increase in T-bond rates increases my earnings to price ratio by 0.52. So think about it. If my T-bond rate goes up, the earnings to price ratio goes up. Earnings to price ratio goes up, P ratio decreases. You're saying, what's a 5.95? That's my T statistic. Remember the rule, if it's greater than 2, it's statistically significant. And on my T-bond minus T-bill rate, there's a negative coefficient, but the T-statistic is less than 1, which means you're dealing more with noise than with statistics. I would remove that. The reason I've left it in there is I've run this regression for a while, and it used to look much better, this T-bond minus T-bill rate in 2008. In the last 12 years, the significance of both the T-bond rate and the slope of the yield curve have decreased. If you look at the T-statistics over time, interest rates have less explanatory power when it comes to price earnings ratios now than they did in 2008. You can blame QE, QE1, QE2, Fed, whoever you want to blame, but it doesn't matter. So let me ask you a question. If I showed you this regression up here, that's my updated regression, and asked you, are stocks today under or overpriced? Is there a way you could use that regression to answer the question? Let's say April 1st, 2020. I could go plug in the T-bond rate, right? The T-bond rate on April 1st, 2020 was, I'll put in the numbers and I'm gonna leave this for you to calculate, was 0.7%. So a T-bond rate of 0.7%. And the T-bill rate at the start of April 2020 was 0.05%. 0.7%, 0.05%. What I want you to do is plug those numbers in to this regression and then use that to tell me whether stocks today are cheap or expensive. And I'll send you the answer in a follow-up email. But try it out. It's a very simplistic way of being your own market strategist. I know we've done a lot today, but let me do one more thing and we'll end for the day. I want to talk a little bit about a ratio called the PEG ratio. You're saying, what's a PEG ratio? PEG ratio is the PE ratio divided by expected growth in earnings per share. So let me give you an example. Let's suppose you have a stock with a PE ratio of 20. And an expected growth of 10% in the next 5 years. Take 20 divided by 10, I get a PEG ratio of 2. You're saying, how is that useful? Equity research analysts who track high growth companies want low PEG ratios. That's a measure of stock being cheap because they're saying, look, I get a PE ratio that's low relative to the growth rate. And the genesis of this approach actually came from a book that Peter Lynch wrote. in the early 1980s. Peter Lynch, for those of you who don't know, was the founder of, well, not the founder, but one of the person who built up Fidelity Magellan, one of the first growth mutual firms from nothing into one of the largest mutual funds in the world. So he was one of the first people to actually systematically invest in growth stocks. And then he wrote about his experiences. He said, look, when I invested in growth stocks, I couldn't just pick low PE stocks because then nothing looked cheap to me. So what I did was I brought growth into the equation. And he never quite used PEG ratios, but he basically talked about how growth has to be part of the analysis. So that's the basis of PEG ratios. And many of the analysts who use PEG ratios make the argument that by using PEG ratios, you can compare companies with different growth rates. So you can compare a 2% growth rate company with a 20% growth rate company. You can't do it with PE ratios, but you can do it with PEG. Implicitly, what they're saying is growth doesn't matter when you use PEG ratios because it's neutralized. Let's see if that's true. To answer that question, here's what I did. I went back to that two-stage dividend discount model I showed you earlier. And then I divided both sides by earnings and growth. So basically, I ended up with an equation for the PEG ratio. You think this is incredibly complicated. What does it tell me? Remember the argument that when you use PEG ratios, growth goes away? Well, that's clearly not true because growth is still part of that equation. It's all over the place. In fact, it's more complicated than it used to be. In fact, if you look at that equation, as I increase risk, PEG ratios decrease. So a higher risk company should have lower PEG ratios. And dividing PE by growth doesn't neutralize growth. Growth stays in the equation because it's not going to go away. So I'm going to use that insight on a final example for today. I went back to that high growth company I showed you earlier. Remember the 25% growth for the next 5 years, 8% thereafter. And I computed a PEG ratio for the company where I plugged in the numbers and I came up with a PEG ratio of 1.15. Again, what is it telling me? If this stock were priced the way it should be given fundamentals, if it were valued correctly, it should be trading at a PEG ratio of 1.15. Take a look at that number. Already we've dispensed with a rule of thumb that people use, which is if a PEG ratio is less than one, a stock is cheap. This stock trading at 1.15 times growth is actually trading at a fair value. It's neither cheap nor expensive. So that rule of thumb must be wrong. And it is wrong because it doesn't factor in so many issues. In fact, what I did was I took the PEG ratio and I did a couple of what ifs. First, I said, what will happen to the PEG ratio if I increase risk? Hey, no surprise. As I make my stocks riskier, PEG ratio decreases. You know how this shows up? I picked up an equity research report, I think sometime last year, on a very risky tech company. And the analyst had used PEG ratios. And his argument for why the stock was cheap is he's comparing the PEG ratio for this company to the PEG ratio for the S&P 500. He said, my stock is cheap. Its PEG ratio is 0.8. The PEG ratio for the S&P 500 is 1.18. And I said, that doesn't make sense. You have a young, risky company. You can't compare to the S&P 500. So when you're comparing stocks with different risk, you should expect riskier stocks to have lower PEG ratios. Second, what if I asked was, what if I had a higher retention ratio, which is the equivalent of a higher return equity? As my return on equity increases, so basically that's what you should read as you go left across, is I'm increasing the efficiency of my growth, I have lower PEG ratios. What does that mean? Well, if I have a really low PEG ratio for a stock, I'm sorry, as the retention ratio increases, I'm getting less efficient. If you have a really low PEG ratio for a stock, it could be not just that it's cheap, but it has a terrible return equity. So let's see, if you see a stock with a low PEG ratio, it could be very risky. It could have a terrible return equity. Already we're lining up what we're looking for on making sure we don't have in a stock. So higher returns in equity will push up your PEG ratios. Lower risk will push up your PEG ratios. Then I did a what if on growth and my stomach fell because here's what I saw. As growth increased, initially the PEG ratio decreased. So I said, this is good. Higher growth companies should have lower PEG ratios. But then at some point it started going up again. It's almost a U-shaped distribution. And that's really messy when it comes to using PEG ratios. Because now if I asked you, is higher growth good or bad for PEG ratios? You really can't answer because look at this graph. So let's summarize. High risk companies should have much lower PEG ratios than low risk companies. So if you see a company with a really low PEG ratio, it could be cheap or it could just be the riskiest stock in the market. Second, companies that attain growth more efficiently by investing less will have higher PEG ratios than companies that don't. So if you see a really low PEG ratio, check the return equity. Often the return equity will be low or maybe even negative. Companies with very low or very high growth rates, remember the U-shaped distribution, will have higher PEG ratios than companies that fall in the middle. So if you're looking for a cheap stock on a PEG ratio basis, tell me what you want. Do you want a low PEG ratio? You want high risk or low risk? Oh, you want low risk. Okay, good. You want low return equity or high return equity? Oh, you want high return equity. So you want low PEG, low risk, high return equity. As far as growth goes, you want low growth or high growth? Well, you can take either. You just don't want average growth, right? Because you don't want anything that explains away the PEG ratio. I think PEG ratios are horrifically bad multiples that they should not be used, but at least you now have the ammunition to see why. Let's do one final multiple. And I promised you that the last one was the last one. This one is the last one. I took price to book. I did exactly what I did with PE ratios, started with the stable growth dividend discount model. And I ended up with an equation for the price to book ratio for a company. Notice there's an extra variable that pops up. With multiples, I always talk about companion variables. And people say, what are you talking about? So one number I need to know to use that multiple. So with price to book, that companion variable is return equity, the variable that popped up when I did the algebra. So basically, I've just taken a stable growth dividend discount model, divided both sides by the book value, ended up with the price to book ratio. You're saying, what does a companion variable do? Let's say you're trying to sell me a stock and telling me its price to book is really low. You know the one question, and you allowed me only one question. The one question I'd ask you is, what's its return equity? Most of the time, when you see stocks with low price to book, you'd see low return equity. High price to book, high return equity. In fact, last page for today, here's what I did. I went back into my fundamental growth equation. Remember the fundamental growth equation, that retention ratio times return equity? If I plug that back into this equation at the bottom of page 42, I can rewrite the price to book ratio as return in equity minus the growth rate divided by cost of equity minus the growth rate. That's an incredibly intuitive equation. And here's why. If you have a stock that roughly earns its cost of equity, return equity is equal to cost of equity, its price to book should be roughly one. If you have a stock that consistently earns less than its cost of equity, return equity is less than the cost of equity, it should trade at less than book value. Doesn't make it cheap. And if a stock has a return equity higher than the cost of equity, its price to book value will be higher. You're saying, but this is for a stable growth company. You're right. But remember what we showed. If this company is a high growth company, the variable still remain return equity, cost of equity, and growth rate. So the relationship just gets a little messier between those variables and the price to book. Last page, I tried this on EV to invested capital, which is the enterprise value analog to price to book. So what I did was I took the enterprise value equation, divided both sides. And if you look at the bottom of this page, I have enterprise value divided by invested capital is return on capital minus the growth rate divided by cost of capital minus the growth. If that looks familiar, take a look at the previous page. Price to book is return equity minus the growth rate divided by cost of equity minus the growth. This is my firm value analog. A firm value multiple, enterprise value to invested capital, will be a function of the relationship between return on capital and cost of capital. If you're the kind of company that earns your cost of capital, your enterprise value is going to be equal to your invested capital. Remember the invested capital, that's the base of your return on invested capital. So it's a very simplistic way of extracting the variables that drive that multiple. So that's pretty much what I had planned to do today. I know we've done a lot, reviewed the slides, and as I said, I'll have extended office hours. You can come in and ask me any questions you have about anything that came up today. But we're laying the foundations for doing pricing right, because if we can lay the foundation, pricing is going to be a pretty simple exercise. But if we don't, it's so easy to slip up. Thank you.